What's good, family? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, the host of Black and Published Podcast, and the author of the novel, The Seven Daughters of Dupree. This historical fiction novel is about the secrets kept between mothers and daughters over the course of seven generations, and is told backwards in time from 1995 to 1860. The Seven Daughters of Dupree was published January 27, 2026, and is available everywhere books are sold. So if you can, please consider getting a copy of The Seven Daughters of Dupree today.
Nicki Minaj has that song, Moment for Life. And that's how I felt. I wish I had this moment for life. Like I could bottle this feeling of, yes, it has finally happened. My childhood dream of having my poetry book on a bookshelf has finally happened.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published on the Mahogany Books Podcast Network, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. So, the Super Bowl is on Sunday. Bad Bunny's performing at halftime, and so it's only right to kick off the season 6 premiere, giving props to Puerto Rico. Today's guest is Dorcia Smith Silva, author of the poetry collection In Inheritance of Drowning, a collection born out of Dorcia's experience living through Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico in 2017, as well as her experience of mothering and witnessing the racial reckoning of 2020 that reminded her of the constant exploitation of the island she calls home.
The colonialism that Puerto Ricans face with the U.S. treatment, it's the same treatment Black African Americans face in the United States. That same kind of yardstick, it's the same.
Dorcia, a Philly native, is not afraid to proclaim her collection is protest poetry. The reason she says she cannot write light verse. Plus, as a tenured professor at the University of Puerto Rico, she details how long she had to put her creative dreams aside to secure her career. And why she believes poetry is the form that offers the most freedom. That and more is next, when Black and Published continues. First question, when did you know that you were a writer?
I knew when I was a young child. My parents always took me to the public library. You know, I grew up in Philly, so went to the Wordsworth Library, world full of books. I remember that so vividly, being so excited to pick out a new book. And I would go for the books that had the little sticker on it. I didn't know what it meant at the time, but I knew, ooh, gold sticker, silver sticker. This has to be some kind of a magical book. So I grew up with writers, James Baldwin, Rita Dubb, Alice Walker, all those. And I just said, ooh, look what they can do. Look at their names on the wall. Dude, I was so amazed. I was like, their names are the book. Look at them on the wall. So I thought, well, I could do that. I could write. And so when I was young, I would have my little poems. And I thought, maybe one day I'll be a writer. And then seeing all those books on the walls, I just knew one day my name is going to be up there. One day I'm going to have a book. It took a while. And I took a different path because I became a professor. And at my university, there's no creative writing path. So I knew that going in. But when I got the letter and the phone call, you're a full professor. Okay, thank you. Back to poetry. And I just took off. I just took off writing. And then what happened also was we had Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. So it was like a horrible hurricane. Think of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. So all of a sudden you have power, electricity, water, then all of a sudden you don't have anything. So I was writing about it in this journal. And little by little, I was like, wait a minute, the journals are getting full. And time went by, I went back to the journals and I said, this is poetry. And I was like, I think I have enough for a book. So Cavan Carey had been on my radar. They had an open call. I sent them my work, I sent it in August. I got the phone call in March. And when I got that call, I was really thrilled. So finally, I can say I am a published poet. I am an author of creative writing. And it feels so good. It's like, yes, yes, yes. But at the same time, the validation comes from yourself. The fact that you did it is out there in the world. And I'm proud of it. The story is about global warming. It's about the racial, social, political injustices. It's about police brutality. The book contains so much. I was writing part of this, I didn't know at the time during Hurricane Maria, but the other part came during COVID. And I said it was really hard to see the positivity during that time. You had so many people that were perishing, so many people that were full of anxiety. It just wasn't a time of thinking, well, where's the joy in the world?
Why was poetry always the medium that you were drawn to instead of any other kind of creative writing?
I think because poetry to me offers the most freedom. This is what I always tell my students. I said, one word can be a poem. I, there's your poem. And you can express it in different ways. Poetry, you can act it out. You can have a dramatic poem. I said, you can have poetry that could be a sonnet. Now, so many poets have taken the traditional sonnet, Shakespearean, Petrarchan, and have completely exploded that form. So you have people that have taken the VNL and they're like, wait a minute, I don't want to do this traditional one. I'm going to do a spin on this, a take on this, make it my own. So that's what I love about poetry is that you have the prose poem, you have poems where people will say, you know what, I'm going to start it off like this and I'm going to end it with erasure. Even erasure poems have different forms. You can have the blackout, you can have overlayering of words, you can have words that people are going to try to like fill in. And I said, that's the beauty of poetry, the creativity behind it, that there really are no limitations to what you can do. And you can just have your mind be expanded with poetry. And I love that about poetry, that you look at what's been done and you say, okay, this is what's been done, but this is where I'm going to take it. And I love creating different forms. I love what Jericho Brown has done with the duplex. It's just amazing. And what other people have done, they've taken the duplex and they'll say, okay, I have this duplex, but now I'm going to have part two and part three, and I'm going to have it turn into a sonnet. Or I'm going to have it be a flaming poem where, we narrow it down till it's just going to be maybe three or four lines. What can I do with this? And I love that because then you say, oh, wow, that inspires other people to take more risks. And that's what poetry is all about.
You talked about knowing that the university that you were going to and going to be teaching, there was no room for creative writing if you wanted to get your full professorship and be on a tenure track. And you were at the University of Puerto Rico. In that time where you put your creative writing to the side, was it truly like on the back burner? You didn't touch it, you didn't think about it, you weren't writing anything, not even anything in your phone or a journal, and you were purely focused on your career?
It was, I would say, somewhat on the back burner. But what I would do is, for instance, I got in touch with doing a lot of research on mothering through a group in Canada, the Association of Research on Mothering, based at the University of Toronto and York University in Toronto, Canada. So what happened was I got in touch with them. I have published and edited some books through them. And keeping in touch with the creative side, they would say, well, we have these poetry books. Would you like to write a review of these poetry books? So I was like, oh, yes, sure. And meanwhile, I was always in touch with other poets. So even though I wasn't writing poetry, my mentor, God bless her, who crossed over not too long ago, Velma Pollard from Jamaica, great, wonderful writer, creative writer in fiction, also a poet. She would always say, Dorcia, you have to decide what you want. You have a good job. You have to be focused because the tenure track, it's so brutal. You're only given so much time to fulfill all these publications and all these other kind of commitments that the university wants you to do. And you know that going in, but it's like a beast once you're in the middle of it. So I would try to be somewhat aligned with that creative side, but not tap into it 100% because I knew you only have 5 years to get tenure. And in those 5 years, you're on committees, you have to teach various classes, you have to publish, you have to go to conferences. And now that I'm on the other side of that, immersing myself with promoting the book and going to different readings. And I just found out one of my proposals got accepted to AWP conference. So now, which is wonderful news, I'm very excited about that. But I see now it would have been very challenging to have been in both worlds. I think I would have been cheating my creative writing side if I had tried to do that as well as fully immerse myself in the commitment on the road to get tenure.
What did it feel like to come back to the poetry that you've loved since you were a child and be able to fully immerse yourself in this world of creative writing and getting ready to go to AWP in Baltimore?
It feels wonderful. You know, I feel so fulfilled, and I think my students see it. It's like a joy. I feel lighter. I feel like a load has been lifted. I feel the best way to say it, beautiful and self-fulfilled. There's nothing like fulfilling that dream. And I know many people say, well, why didn't it happen sooner? Why couldn't you do this? And I say, all roads have led me to this particular path. Like, I couldn't have written this debut book if I hadn't gone through Hurricane Maria. I couldn't have written this book if I wasn't a mother, if I hadn't done all that research too on mothering, because it adds another layer to your experience and your writing process and also the discipline. Because once you get that yes from the publisher, you have deadlines too. It's not like, oh, you got the yes from the book, that's it. The publisher was like, listen, if you want to polish this, if you want to add another poem, if you want to do this, and there's the deadline. And even when you're trying to promote the book, you have to be organized because I'm still working at the same time. I don't have it like that where I can just say to my students, I'm going on a book tour for 2 weeks. I'll see you later. No. So I'm still teaching and promoting the book and trying to do readings outside of Puerto Rico. So I'm trying to juggle all that. So the discipline, I think, of being a professor and that road to tenure and being a full professor has really helped me with this book because I see my calendar and I see when I have free time and you make it happen. And I tell my students, what is it that you want? You have to be dedicated. There's a certain kind of commitment you have because I see with, I have a son, he's young, and sometimes I see this very lax behavior and it's like, well, it's going to happen. Nothing's going to happen unless you are motivated to help it happen. I mean, unless you're just really lucky. But I tell them luck is opportunity and the discipline. You have to have some kind of motivation behind it. Very few people just have things fall into their laps.
And so then in thinking about that and your publishing process, you mentioned that you had been journaling and writing through Hurricane Maria and the different experiences that were happening in the 20 teens with the rampant murders and lynchings of Black people by either police or vigilantes in their neighborhoods, and that all of those things became what is an inheritance of drowning. The way you described it, it seems like Cave and Carrie and you were meant to be, like, it was very quick and it was a very quick yes from the start. I know you say you have to have your own internal validation, but what did that immediate yes to something that you had been wanting for so long, decades, it sounds like, mean to you?
It felt like when you wake up in the morning and the sunlight filters and hits your face, and you'd feel like, oh, yes, I feel so beautiful. That's what it felt like. It felt like, yes, I'm going to bring this book into the world. I have a publisher that is going to support me and bring it out into the world. And it was an experience that almost moved me to tears. As soon as I got that phone call, I had a moment where I was like, okay, hold yourself. Don't break down on the phone. Exhale. And it was like, yes, it's finally happened. Like the moment I have been waiting for has finally happened. Nicki Minaj has that song, Moment for Life. And that's how I felt. I wish I had this moment for life. I could bottle this feeling of, yes, it has finally happened. My childhood dream of having my poetry book on a bookshelf has finally happened. My press mate, Nadia Alexis, who also is a wonderful poet, she's from New York. But she lives in Mississippi now. And she was so kind. She said, Dorcia, your book is on, and I forget how many shelves of libraries, but she knows my childhood dream. So she told me, she was like, your book is on blah, 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 number of bookshelves for libraries. And I was like, Nadia, I said, I am so happy about that. I said, but for me, really, as long as it's on one bookshelf in a library, I am happy. I said, because that was just my dream. You know, really, I was like, if it's just on one,
So is it on the
I'm
is it
happy.
on the shelf in the Wadsworth Library in Philly?
I hope so. I haven't checked. I said I would check, but I have not, but I hope so. And if it's not, that is something I'd be willing to donate. So my dream really is now to go back to Wadsworth Library. And if it is not on the bookshelf, to be like, listen, when I was a child, I came here every weekend and I had a dream. Please put this book on the bookshelf so I can take a photo with this on the bookshelf, you know. So I would love to do that.
And so then, and having that dream come true and it being on so many different shelves, what was your experience like in looking through your journal and pulling together the collection for publication, knowing that it was so deeply personal and tied to so much trauma and tragedy?
When I went back to the journal, I was in disbelief that what I had written was actually poetry. And so that was like my first feeling, like, wow, I wrote poetry. And then my second thought was, oh my goodness, like even during those moments of extreme trauma, I was still tapping into that poetic, creative side. And then three, I said, okay, I'm going to now shape this into what I could put on the page. My concern a little bit was this is so revealing. But then I said, you know what? But someone has to tell the story. And I always tell that to my students. Now, who else is going to tell your story but yourself? So I said, you know what? I have to preach what I tell my students. Who else is going to tell this story but us? Because so many people didn't know really about Hurricane Maria, or it was like, that just happened. That was in the Caribbean. Get over it. Y'all are fine now. No, we're not fine. That happened in 2017. And just like in Hurricane Katrina, you still see some of the damage in New Orleans. You still see the damage in Puerto Rico all these years later. You still see the weakness of the infrastructure. So it was a way of me feeling, okay, the publisher is going to support me in this journey. And I also wanted to make sure that I honored the experiences of what was also happening in 2020 with police brutality, Black Lives Matter. And it wasn't going to shift me away from telling all these different experiences. And the publisher said, no, this is what you want to do. We'll support you. So that meant a lot to me because sometimes as a writer, I think sometimes you do feel worried if the publisher is going to say, well, there may be perhaps backlash, or you may reach more readers if you do this, this, and this. And I said, I really don't want to do that. This is what I want to do with this book. And the publisher said, yes, go for it.
Why was it important for you to ground the overarching theme of this book in not only the devastation of Hurricane Maria on the island of Puerto Rico, but also tying it to the experience of being Afro-Latina as well as Black American, and really what those experiences are like in terms of race, class, and colonialism?
I couldn't really have the experience of being a Black woman living in Puerto Rico without all of that. The colonialism that Puerto Ricans face with the US treatment, it's the same treatment Black African Americans face in the United States. That same kind of yardstick, it's the same. So you can't have, in my experience, one without the other. When I saw what was happening with Black Lives Matter, I said, this is the same treatment Puerto Ricans get in Puerto Rico. The US government not helping, kind of turning their heads away. I mean, we're seeing this now with the depletion of grants. We're seeing this now with the depletion of resources. Students can't even get free lunches or breakfasts anymore because it's deemed, well, that's a marginalized community. We don't really have to help them. So sad, too bad. And I said, it's that same feeling with Puerto Rico because the majority of Puerto Ricans, lower income, voting Democratic, asking for assistance. You're seen as need, 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 instead of what can you do for us? What can you give us? And I said, the exploitation has to stop somewhere. So this book is really a call for all kinds of social transformation and wanting us to look at where are we going in society? What do we want for our society? And I'm hoping it's a more sustainable, better future. And so, in Inheritance of Drowning, we've been drowning forever. I have a poem in the book that says that we've been drowning since forever. And it means we've been exploited for so long. We've been marginalized for so long. But now's the time to speak up. Now's the time, even more so, for empowerment. Now's the time to say, we're demanding this social transformation. And if you're not going to give it to us, then we're going to work together with our communities and we're going to do it for each other, which is what we're seeing now. You see communities now working together more than ever because you can't ask the government or certain governments for assistance because they say, oh, our hands are tied. We can't do anything. Why can't you do anything? You know, it's frustrating to read about these Supreme Court cases and you say, what? More cuts of funding? Well, you think, well, they're harming everyday citizens. But this is exactly the point. So I wanted to make that point really explicit in the book.
Your themes do come through very explicitly in the collection. And so, with that said, can we go ahead and read three poems from In Inheritance of Drowning, and we can talk more about it?
Sure.
In Inheritance of Drowning, Dorcia Smith Silva divides her debut poetry collection into three parts: Before Hurricane Maria, After Hurricane Maria, and Everything Else. Pulled from the pages of her journal during the worst of the storm, the collection chronicles the immediate aftermath of the hurricane and the recovery that continues to this day in the face of climate change, immigration, racial injustice, the exploitation of Puerto Rico's natural resources, and the fleecing of its people. Here's Dorcia.
So I'm going to read one of my favorite poems from the book. And this I always talk about. Missing BIPOC women, especially Black women that go missing and do not get the national attention they rightly deserve. But so many communities, Native American women too, go missing, don't get the national attention they deserve. But in the poem, I specifically say Black. Ghost Talker poem. And for the Black girls that go missing from newspaper headlines and spotlight 5 p.m. news, what happened to them? Kick the can over, see if the bones glint in the slips of sunshine. Press your ears against the grass. Listen to what bleeds. My mother in her lovely tongue. Those girls are probably with friends hanging out in the basement, wearing cigarette pants. Cigarette pants were fashionable once. They will turn up like loose change sidelined under sofa cushions, overdue books sandwiched in sweaters. Favorite hairpins gagged by vents. Don't fret. Fret is a funny word for a young child. Sounds like forget. Don't forget. I won't. About the missing Black girls. Probably already dead in a ditch or a field somewhere. I'm not supposed to think about death. Passing away, kicked the bucket 6 feet under, meeting our maker, which is what my teacher said. The class guinea pig has stopped moving. Mrs. Hayes poked its feet and then shoved it into a shoebox. Said that we could bury it across from the tire swing in the back of the schoolyard. The dirt was ordinary, brown, hard. Eat your snacks, said my mother. Twinkies from 7-Eleven, maybe Wawa. Nothing from Superfresh or Pathmark. White filling, creamy like white fungus, oozing like zit pus, besmirching golden cake. The news says nothing about Black girls that go missing, not even a speck in someone's unread newspaper. Silence is when we inherit ghosts. I see them taking victory laps every night. The next poem I'm going to read is called Decussate, and I wrote this poem talking about violence. It really came about with all the violence happening in 2020 and people not understanding why violence can be, for some people, a solution to problems, and how violence has been carried out throughout history. Decussate. I'm not saying violence isn't wrong, but I understand it. Mrs. Hayes is quick to remind us, we should never put our hands on anyone. Violence is never the answer. Then she loads the projector. The film crackles on the screen of muskets and cannons, instruments from a war where the 13 colonies gained their freedom by killing men in red. Red like bright breasts of birds, red like big bone leaves on trees. Why couldn't they ask King George for their independence? Carol wants to know. Didn't they ask nicely? The film sputter turns to the Civil War and bombards us with red over blue and gray garments. Men getting pummeled and slaves hoping for a quilt work of freedom. Slaves that never had a prelude of asking nicely. Slaves that swept the dust in breath while masters need them dreamless. Mrs. Hayes has her hands on her hips, like my own mother. When the guidance counselor told her that I would never get accepted by an Ivy League college, her eyes stripping Mr. Connor to a bare letter, his hands on my mother's shoulders and the firm brushing away of fat fingers. The woman's patience trapped her legs, but not her voice. After 2 hours of waiting for the doctor, she screamed and pounded her fists at the counter. The doctor will see you now, the receptionist's eyes widened into black moons. Then a buzz to let her through. The rest of us clutching our shell shock papers. The group of men circled the heart-shaped train rider until she spit-shined a knife and caught a rib. The men dodged like rodeo clowns. I think of my mother. The neighbors, when they were told their children threw stones and dirt into our pool. My mother's tongue slicing them into a stroke ending. Her tongue asking in the place of fists. Tell us when to send the cleanup crew, they say. I understand violence. It starts as the introduction to many wounds. You could press down hard enough if one bleeds. I, Anna, I, Tatiana, Brianna, Fred, Malcolm, Martin, Megger, Sandra, Trayvon, Yvette. They killed our best people. Until the mouths no longer hold stones, when the hands are pure, red will be a color as good, with good, across good. I'm going to read one more. It's called Return, and this is about the migration crisis, how it affects all of us. And I think what's missing with this migration crisis is that people don't realize why people migrate. People always assume they're just coming over for a better life, but people get pushed out from their homelands. People get pushed out because of violence. People also get pushed out because of climate change, and they are desperate to have a better life. And so sometimes when people get sent back, they say, I can't stay because there's nothing here. So they then decide, I'm going to take the chance and come again. So this poem addresses that. It's called Return. The river said, I'll protect you and give you shelter. So we migrants came. We traveled a long journey. The river carried us like familiar wind. Then we walked and dreamed of motionless water, dreamed of water that said, welcome, come, come, come. Then they arrived with hanging scowls, arrived on horses long reined with whips, ran down our black bodies, trampled our faces, maimed our voices, made us turn our backs to water, told us water will not protect you here. That water does not belong to you. Your tears belong to you. That water is yours. That water should be plenty. Our tears scramble across miles. They get caught in many rivers, and our bodies keep drowning. We die in so many ways. They say we have no papers, no roots to dayfall here as we are being sent back. We see the water below us on the plain. It tells us to return. Think of tendrils pushing through the muddy bottom. We can't look away.
And you do one more. Widows.
Oh, yes. Yes. Let me find it. I think it's at the very end. Yes. So this is Widows. And I wrote this because of the devastation of Hurricane Maria. And whenever hurricane season comes, we're always holding our breaths. And then you have the apologies from the government saying, oh, we're going to investigate, but nothing happens. And it's just more sadness all over again. Widows. Hurricane Maria made us all widows. But we didn't have to wear black. We were already in mourning, selves bathed in fight or flight, having lost everything to bits in battlefields of wind rain, clapping. Then FEMA arrived with a box lunch and an IOU for a prepaid cell phone and debit card, forms to fill out asking for proof of home ownership, bank account identification, before they would even consider our claims. The governor came with a caravan of camera crews and wanted to hear our stories. Not the ones about huddling in a hot shelter with expired rice to eat, but the ones about Puerto Rico being the jewel of the Caribbean. The ones about our towns being open for business. For what can we widows do? Hurricane Maria smashed our prefrontal cortices to whittles of dead air. It is mentioned that we are props, flung against a landmark plot. The newspapers said that we cried. They didn't say that we woke up drowning.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You said this book started with you journaling about Hurricane Maria, and then you have the structure of before the storm and after the storm in the book, and in the middle sections, I think it's called By Everything Else, that's when you really talk about the racialized experiences on the mainland United States. What does poetry allow you to give back to your community who are still suffering on the island of Puerto Rico?
Oh, it gives everything. I mean, So many people have said after my reading, oh, I had no idea Puerto Rico went through this. It's still going through this. Thank you. I've had so many people come up to me and say, wow, you're voicing this story. And whatever we write, it is political. And the fact that the book is able to be put in markets where people may not even know about Puerto Rico. It's amazing how many people just live in their little state or little small community, and people don't understand about climate change and how it affects especially marginalized communities the most. I mean, people say, well, why hasn't, Puerto Rico, rebounded? It's the same thing you hear with Hurricane Katrina. I was at the New Orleans Poetry Festival not too long ago, and people were showing the damage. I mean, I think New Orleans has done a great job trying to, revitalize, but still, you can still see watermarks in certain pockets. You can still see damage in certain pockets. It's the same thing here in Puerto Rico. I mean, there's a part of my campus that has a bunch of mold. And I've had students say, well, why isn't that fixed? We're still waiting for a government clearance for the money. I mean, it's ridiculous what you have to go through. My particular area, we just got the insurance money last year. Last year. So you think Hurricane Maria was in 2017, you finally get the insurance money. So now you can fix all that damage. And people say, well, why didn't you fix it before? Because there are thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars worth of damage. And most people just don't have a random $10,000, $15,000 in their bank account to fix everything. And then people say, well, what kind of damage? You have everything from the wind blowing out windows, damaging doors, to filtration, walls crumbling, mold, infestation of mold. And then if people aren't familiar with the infestation of mold, that's thousands of dollars to eventually get rid of that. So many people were not aware of the depth of devastation. And so many people are still unaware that so many communities are at the mercy of FEMA, government aid that you've paid into. Because people say, well, FEMA should have released the funds. We know that. We know FEMA should have released the funds, but we're still waiting for that government aid. And if you have people in positions of power that are going to put in roadblocks to get that aid, then what happens to the damage that's already there? Well, then it just exacerbates. It just keeps becoming more and more and more damage. And then what happens, especially in Puerto Rico, is it puts us in a more vulnerable position. What's going to happen if we had a direct hit? Then we're really going to be back to even worse because we still haven't fixed the damage from Hurricane Maria. So it's getting people to really understand the devastation and understand the reasons why we're in this. I mean, you can't ignore the fact that certain people in positions of power do not want to help certain pockets of New Orleans, and a lot of it's race-based. The same thing with Puerto Rico. A lot of it is based on race, politics, that intersectionality. And the history of that intersectionality is so important. And that's what I also wanted to express in the book. You can't just have one without the other and just say, oh, well, it's just based on people being greedy and exploiting others. But why is that happening? There's a history there. And for Puerto Rico, it's because they're in this very vulnerable, precarious position of colonialism tied into race, history, power. And New Orleans, it's a lot of it's the same. They look at these districts and they say, oh, these are just marginalized people from impoverished backgrounds. We don't have to help them. And so the communities are helping each other. Years later, we're trying to say, if this happens again, this is where you can go. This is where you can find food. This is where you can find shelter. It shouldn't be that way. It's really disgusting and gross.
In your collection, you have a poem, They Came For Us, which talks about like that tension between mainland U.S. citizens who come to Puerto Rico as tourists and how that impacts those who live there. You mentioned that you grew up in Philly. Why did you decide to return to Puerto Rico and immerse yourself in that part of your home and your culture?
I'm originally from Philly. My husband is from Puerto Rico. We met when we were studying in Europe. And when it came time to get married, one of us had to move. And I said, yes, warm weather, done. Where do I sign up? Being by the beach? Yes, I'll take it. So I had to really get used to being in the Caribbean. But when I moved here, I completely immersed myself. I mean, I got my PhD from the University of Puerto Rico, became a professor at the University of Puerto Rico. And living in Puerto Rico is very different than other parts of the Caribbean, because that was one thing I had the opportunity to really travel to Trinidad, to Tobago, to USVI, doing my dissertational research and staying in all these different communities. So the history of Puerto Rico, because it is tied to the US and that history of colonialism, I really then could understand the history of racism even more in the United States. I could link it.
How so?
Living in Puerto Rico, if you want something to happen, there's like a law, for instance, you have to go to US law first. Puerto Rican law cannot conflict with US law. So if, for instance, if Puerto Ricans say, let's have our ships bring in bananas from Panama because it's cheaper, US law will say, no, you have to use our boats, even if it is 10 times more, because US law rules and we want that money. So you look at the exploitation and you say, wow, okay, this is what I saw growing up as a child. You saw so many communities asking for resources, so many communities saying, well, can we have this? Can we have this? And then the government deciding, we don't want to help these people, probably because, yes, they're Black. Majority Black neighborhoods, we're not going to want to help you. No, uh-uh. We want to keep you in this position so that we can exploit you even more. And that's what I see with Puerto Rico. So my husband has a very different experience because he grew up here. He's lived in the US once, and that was for like a year. And his idea of the US is very hard for him to understand. So I always knew, oh my goodness, if I ever have kids, trying to raise strong Black kids in the United States, it's so challenging. So having a son in Puerto Rico, it's so different. He's told he's beautiful, that he's smart. He gets hugs from his teachers. And I said, the Caribbean, it's so different when you are surrounded by people that look like you and that have a different mentality. We want each other to succeed. And what we're seeing now, because of the government trying to give tax breaks to outsiders, people that got pushed out, displaced after Hurricane Maria. You have so many people trying to come in and buy property and push the natives out, or native Puerto Ricans can't afford these exorbitant prices because housing has mushroomed. And it's gross because the government, all they see is the short side of it, the short end sale. Oh, we got these people here buying this vacant lot, but they don't see the Puerto Ricans that live here trying to do something. They don't see that. And so that's why I'm so happy Bad Bunny is calling out the politicians and has promoted my students, the young people, to say, you know what? This current government and the ones that have always been in power, they're not doing anything for you. Vote them out, because we need a big change. And I think that's what we're also seeing from the US. I'm not saying that the Democratic Party is the best, but we're seeing people wanting to shake it up, because this status quo of just accepting the crumbs from the table and saying, well, we're going to give you this, be happy with this, that's not what the young people are looking for. And even people my age, I'm in my 50s, we're fed up. We're saying, this is not what was promised to us. We want this now. Social transformation, which is the this. We want it now. We wanted it yesterday, in fact. And it was promised to us yesterday. It was told it was going to be ours. And we haven't seen it. In fact, we keep seeing this regression. And it's sad and it's frustrating.
Given all that you've said about the history of Puerto Rico and why you moved and why you choose to call it home, what does the United States owe Puerto Rico?
It owes us our freedom. We need to be free yesterday. And I have to say, when I first moved to Puerto Rico, I really didn't understand the level of exploitation. But living here every day, you go food shopping, food prices are so expensive here. And part of that is the history of the Jones Act, which says that Puerto Ricans that live here, Puerto Rican government has to use the ships of the United States. And you think, this is crazy. If there's another island that's closer to Puerto Rico, why can't we get goods from there? No. And it comes down to money. How much can we exploit from this island? So then you start doing your research. And I was just talking to a family member about this, because a family member said, if I move to Puerto Rico, I can't get my SSI benefits, because the government decided if you are a citizen of the United States and you move to Puerto Rico, you lose those benefits. Crazy. I know. So again, exploitation, it comes down to, we're not going to give these people money. We're not going to give them what they are owed, because there are certain companies that are American companies that come here and they pay people less than what they deserve. And the attitude is, well, you should be grateful that we're here.
Your collection is called An Inheritance of Drowning, where you say that Puerto Rico's inheritance is debt and drowning. Given all that we've talked about today, what do you want readers to take from your collection and considering the precarious state that Puerto Rico is in geopolitically.
I hope readers take away that it's not too late for social transformation. It's not too late to push for that social action, to push for that empowerment. I really think that we are on the brink of that. You have certain people in social media, like Bad Bunny, for instance, calling upon youth to start looking at what can we do to push certain leaders in government out and start getting more activists in those positions. People that are going to say, you know what, we're tired of the status quo. We're really going to put Puerto Rico first, even if it means upsetting people in the United States government. And that might be the way to go. If you disrupt that mantle, maybe that disruption would then push them to say, you know what, give them their freedom. Because if you look at history, very few times can you ask nicely for your freedom. The United States didn't ask nicely for its freedom. There was a war. And even with slavery, there was a war. And when you think of civil rights, blood was shed. So very few times in history for there to be real social transformation has it been a peaceful process, because people are afraid of giving away those rights. So in that sense, the time is now. The time was yesterday, but the time is really much now. So please join me. Join me in this social transformation in the United States, as well as in Puerto Rico.
Do you see your collection as protest poetry?
Oh, definitely. I'm very much a believer that what you write is political. And I could not write something that was light verse, because what's happening right now, there's so many calls for action. So this book is that. And I think Vincent Toro, who wrote the introduction to the book, he very much aligns with my mentality that writing is protest poetry. The call for social action comes from all of us. And it's sort of our civic duty to push for social transformation, be a catalyst.
So I want to switch to a speed round in a game before I let you go for the afternoon. What is your favorite book?
Oh my goodness. Anything by Audre Lorde. I also love James Baldwin. Rita Dove is also a must on my list. Anything really by those three writers. You know, Langston Hughes, A Book of Poetry, greatest collection of Langston Hughes too. Throw that in there.
Okay, then who is your favorite author?
One of those four. I can't just pick one. You know, it's like, which banger do you love the most?
So we're going to say Audre Lorde, Baldwin, Langston Hughes, and Rita Dove for the first three questions for your favorite book, favorite author, and favorite poet. Name a poet you think people don't know enough about.
Craig Santos Perez. He is a writer who talks about Guam. And when I read his work for the first time, I saw so many links between Guam and Puerto Rico. And I really was very ignorant about Guam, really didn't know a lot about the history. But reading his books about poetry about Guam, I saw so many similarities. The same dismissal of basic rights, same exploitation, so many links there.
If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
I really like France. I can totally see why James Baldwin and so many Black writers decided to leave the United States and go there. I could see myself in France. And I also really like Hawaii as well. It's very similar to Puerto Rico as far as like the driving in the mountainous region. But I have to say, like, at night, the breeze was so beautiful. It's like a cooler breeze than Puerto Rico. I was like, oh my gosh, just get that hammock and just stick it outside. I was like, okay, Hawaii. This is lovely.
Name three things on your bucket list.
I always said that I would write a screenplay. And so I'm working on that now. Two would be, I guess, to perhaps travel to Japan. I'm really fascinated with the Japanese culture, their technology. And I think I would really also like their gardens. I have all these photos of their forests. So that would be like number two. And then let's see, number three, what else would I do? I think I've already done that number three on my list, which was to publish my first poetry book. I guess have a second poetry book, have a follow-up collection, which I'm also working on right now.
What brings you joy?
Seeing the color green. I really believe that the color green of nature is positivity, and definitely being with my family, really close friends, trying to meditate and just pray. And just really trying to stay grounded and just remember that when people say like, oh, you should be doing this, you should be doing that. I'm a very firm believer in that a lot of this we can't take with us. So it's like one of those moments where you realize, especially after you go through something like a major hurricane, you know, family, close friends, yourself, whatever you believe in, spirituality, whatever is your God and nature. That really keeps me grounded. So that brings me joy.
What brings you peace?
Knowing that I feel like I'm manifesting my destiny. So that really brings me peace. I'm finally at the sweet spot of my life. I don't have to worry about being promoted. I don't have to prove anything to anybody anymore. I just do my business and live with my life. At this point, people kind of come and go in and out your life, and you feel like that's okay. People move or have issues with you. As long as it doesn't involve me or my family, peace be with you, but I have my own peace.
All right. And so our game is called Rewriting the Classics. Classic is however you define it. Name one book you wished you would have written.
Pride and Prejudice. I really wish there was like a more like BIPOC version of Pride and Prejudice. And I mention that because the book would really be about how we make judgments on each other. We prejudge each other all the time. People look at them, other people, and they say, oh, you must be this because you look like this, or you have that, or you drive this car, or you said this. And I said, so the book would be like a modernized version of people having biases against each other and just realizing that we all have deep down, hopefully, like the same heart. And that's what I would want the book to be about. People judging each other, but then realizing we all have the same heart. Like we all want good things to happen to each other. So I would like that without the whole backdrop of getting married, all that silly stuff.
So name one book where you want to change the ending, and how would you do it?
I would probably change Passing by Nella Larsen, the ending, because it drives me nuts trying to figure out, was she pushed or not? Was it an accident or not? So knowing myself, make it a little bit more obvious to the reader that the central character pushed the other one. She really didn't fall to her demise by accident. It was like, oh yes, I pushed her out that window because she had to go. She was too much of a threat.
And so then name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught, and why?
One that comes to mind is The Goldfinch. Has anybody read that book, The Goldfinch? That book, I'm sorry, it was awful. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to say that it's an awful book, but it was widely praised. I think they're making it into a film, but the book was boring, really bloated, full of stereotypes. I would not recommend that book. And it was one of those like bestseller New York Times. And it just goes to show you, not everything on the New York Times bestseller list should be a New York Times bestseller book. So don't read The Goldfinch. It's way too long. Read something else.
And so my final question for you today, when you're dead and gone among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about the legacy of words and work that you left behind?
Oh, wow. I hope that they say that I was an agent of change and that I cared about humanity and wanted the best for our communities.
Big thank you to Dorcia Smith-Silva for being here today on Black and Published. You can follow Dorcia on the socials at dsmithsilva on Instagram and Threads. And make sure you check out An Inheritance of Drowning. It's out now from Cave and Carry. You can get a copy of the collection from Mahogany Books and get 10% off your first purchase using code BLACKPUB at checkout. That's BLKPUB. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Dorcia about what she thinks it will take for Puerto Rico to become a nation independent of the U.S. once again. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Ebony Liddell, author and editor of the HBCU short story romance collection, You've Got a Place Here Too.
I was trying to convince my cousin to go to HBCU. I was like, oh, you should go to Howard. And he's from the South. And he's like, nah, it's too city for me. And so I'm like, okay, you're right. It is too city for you. So what would it look like if you saw a representation of an HBCU in the South? And you're like, okay, this is more my speed. And so that really got my gears turning of, okay, what can I do to like showcase multiple HBCUs?
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.
What's going on, family? This is Derek Young.
And Ramonda Young.
Owners of both Mahogany Books and the Mahogany Books Podcast Network.
We really want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this episode. And if you enjoyed what you just heard, drop us a review and rate us on whatever platform you download podcasts on.
We truly appreciate each and every one of you for supporting us and making us your go-to for Black books. And we look forward to connecting with you all sometime in the future.
Thank you again, fam. And always remember, Black books matter.